You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello again, this is Matthew Raphael Johnson, another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist, and this is being recorded very late, April 26, 2025. I came across a CIA document completely by accident, in English. We're going to talk about it here in a little bit. And it's significant because we're dealing with the nature of the Cold War, we're dealing with the nature of both what Russian nationalism actually is and how it's perceived. The notion of Soviet patriotism is not the same as Russian nationalism, certainly of its Orthodox variety. It's also not the same as National Bolshevism. And these are all fairly broad ideologies, but we have to be very careful. And the way that analysts deal with these, it's usually very distorted. The CIA document I'm talking about is partly responsible for this. It makes elementary errors in interpretation, but it does buttress the idea that the Cold War from the American side was anti-Russian, not anti-communist. But to the extent that that was true, the Communist Party could rely, or at least use, some variant of popular patriotism. As far as the citizen was concerned, where it came from wasn't important, so long as they weren't too loud about it. Soviet patriotism is really a mishmash of ideologies. It doesn't exist on its own. It has to rely on Russian Orthodox qualities, but of course still rejected the source of those qualities, Logos, God. I came across a document from 1961 called The Moral Code of the Builder of Communism. And this is, of course, an official document from the Soviet Union. And if you would remove references to Marxism there, it's not a bad thing. It talks about the love for the motherland, asceticism, devotion, hard work, fraternal solidarity, especially with the oppressed, mutual assistance, the war against evil, and many other things. But the problem is, this is exclusively for the cause of socialist revolution and your activities after the revolution. But like all of these ideologies, it's parasitic on the previous values that it rejects. The Russian values and characteristics on which this kind of Stalinist communism relied were just so necessary for its continued existence that it had to encourage them, but it had to package it in communist terminology. And that became even more fierce in the Brezhnev period. The Khrushchev period was very fanatically godless. But there were people, we're talking about roughly 60s, 70s, 80s, there were plenty of people that tried to connect these values to their divine source, Logos. Especially after Khrushchev was overthrown, there were attempts to expand the permitted boundaries of what nationalism was, especially when understanding the whole of Russian history. The claims of loyalty to the Soviet system are simply tactical. You had a lot of movements like that, the so-called human rights movement. Well, you know, that's a liberal idea. It was supported by the West for that reason, but it could be used. It could be used to achieve some kind of observance of the historical rights of the Russian nation and Orthodoxy. Nazarov and many others I've quoted call this movement the Russia Party or the Russian Party. It was very broad. The core of it was Russian nationalism as opposed to Soviet patriotism. For decades, this was vehemently condemned. Laws against it were never taken off the books, but things began to fall apart in the Brezhnev era. Unlike the westernized liberal dissent, which is far more powerful, which is often Jewish, Russian-oriented dissent didn't have any support in the West. Its media, human rights organizations, it was constantly slandered, especially during the years of perestroika under Gorbachev. The document I'm talking about from the CIA condemned this movement vehemently. The document was written in 1971. They're talking about nationalist anti-Semitism back then. The document laid out exactly what the West is fighting, and it had nothing to do with Marxism. Western, quote, experts, who are always wrong about these things, were fighting the Communist Party because it has this variant, according to them, this Russian nationalist variant. They saw, in times of crisis, how the regime is able to call on roughly national Bolshevik ideas, mutations, as Stalin did during the war. But westernized liberals, that kind of dissent in the USSR, yes, it was persecuted, not nearly as much. It was also larger, but they also disguised their agenda under the ideals of socialism, which is much easier to do. The document I'm talking about, it wasn't very long. It's tough to read in the condition that it's in. March of 1971, declassified in 2005, only released in 2015. Some of it is very difficult to read, but it's very clear as to the agenda. Let me quote it here. I'm going to quote it at length, and when I publish this, I'm going to have the document number and links and everything else. Again, this is straight CIA. This is an official description that, as far as I can see, was taken very seriously and became the Cold War standard. I'm going to quote it here. The liberal end of the Soviet political spectrum, whatever real weight it carries, has been relatively visible to the West for several years. Soviet liberals have turned to the West for inspiration and aid, and their cause has attracted attention, often born of hope, from many in the West. Soviet reactionaries have little interest in publicizing their views before Western audiences, but recently they have said and written enough to provide a rather complete model of political thought of an extremist type against which more commonly held opinion in the USSR can be measured. The reported political ties and activities of the ultra-conservatives, moreover, shed light on some of the motives in the decision-making process within the Politburo. The policies that emerged from this process helped to identify the limits imposed by Soviet leaders by the need for consensus in the Kremlin. Anti-Semitism, before and after the revolution, has been a conservative force at three levels of national life: the popular, the political, and the philosophical. It was endemic to the Russian masses before the revolution and has hardly been shed by their descendants. The new proletariat class and ruling elite of the Soviet Union, the Tsars pandered to anti-Semitism as a convenient outlet for popular frustrations. Stalin turned to it with more frequency after he had completed his transformation of society and was intent on freezing the mold. Now, I could do a whole show unpacking this nonsense, but it is very striking. I was searching for a name and on Yandex, and this came up. It's very significant here. Ultra-conservatives. This is in the Politburo. This is not... You know, these aren't factions in society. These are, you know, they're saying that this exists in the ruling elite. In other words, there's nationalist anti-Semites in the Communist Party. This was a construction of the CIA and many others that allowed the anti-communist movement to claim power from the regime as a whole. They want to monitor the limits imposed by Soviet leaders on this movement. They're worried about this need for consensus might mean that they have to give in to some of these extremists. That anti-Semitism is just somehow built into the Russian mind. The popular, the political, and the philosophical, they don't really talk about the philosophical. I don't think they could. Endemic to the Russian masses, whatever that might mean. And it has never gone away. In other words, it's just simply a part of the Russian mind. Hence, that mind has to be destroyed. Over time, and this became standard in ruling circles in the U.S., and in this document itself, Stalinism, anti-Semitism, nationalism are all one thing in the mind of the CIA and hence in the mind of the ruling elite in the West. So let's be clear. This is just one proof out of many. The CIA in the West fought the communists in this era, not because of Marxism, which they probably didn't understand, but because of nationalism and anti-Semitism. Woodrow Wilson said the same thing at the beginning during the revolution, and he was willing to give aid so long as they don't act like czars, which is a direct quote from him. They call them either conservative or ultra-conservative movements. In other words, by this understanding, monarchists and Orthodox nationalists were seen then and now as Stalinists in this new definition. I remember when the fall of the Soviet Union, 1991-92, the use of the word conservative to describe communist hardliners in the Soviet leadership, I thought it just came out of ignorance. They're conservative. In other words, there's no principles behind it. It's just they want to preserve something. Of course, it's a stupid definition. No, they meant conservative as in somehow, you know, ethno-nationalist and anti-Semitic. We've talked about this at great length on the show over the last, I don't know, year or so. It's because of stuff like this we have to continue to discuss, to understand. I mean, we're rewriting 20th century history here. We know almost every aspect of it needs to be rewritten from top to bottom. But Nazarov and many others talk about the Russian national movement, whether it's strictly nationalist in any definition of the term or just national. It's nationally oriented from the 60s to the 80s. Was very important. It is true that there were members of the ruling elite in the Soviet Union that were sympathetic to it, but usually using Leninist and Marxist term. Stalinist national Bolshevism, there's a similarity here, but only superficially so, because the impetus of this national movement didn't come from the Communist Party itself, with the goal of harnessing the population to some goal, but came from the leading layers of the Russian people, the nation itself, directed against Marxist ideology, but also worried about what might happen if the Soviet Union collapses and the Western liberal and Jewish dissidents take over. Now that's the key element. We know what happened in Russia in the 1990s. It almost disappeared. That is not an exaggeration. The state, the people, this was cheered on. This was democracy. Same thing for Ukraine sometime later. Oligarchy, the disappearance of the Russian nation was associated with democracy in progress. I distinctly remember that. Of course, it's not that hard to find anymore. The Western oligarchs, what we call the regime today, really only took form after the end of the Cold War and starting in the early 90s, took its form that I use the term. The so-called New World Order that didn't exist when the Soviet Union was around. Again, Soviet Union being at least partly comprised of these Russians that have to be removed. But this liberal westernization project is one of the factors of the Cold War became the fifth column of the Western oligarchy in Russia. Patriotic dissent wanted to get rid of Marxism, but not at any cost. Solzhenitsyn was very much a part of this. Russia had to be revived first as a nation, as an ideal. And it can't just be opposed to the Communist Party, but also the banking elites in the West and everything that what eventually happened. This opposition wasn't just a post-war phenomenon. It existed throughout the 20th century. We could even include the Black Hundreds, the Orthodox peasants who rebelled in the 1920s, the white forces under General Dietrich, the Russian Orthodox emigration, Jordanville, all that. And all of them, the emigration, of course, wanting to support their friends in Russia and Ukraine itself. Russian patriotic descent, that's not the same thing as Soviet patriotism. In the post-Stalin era, that can be very difficult to trace, especially if you don't read Russian. You did have some legal movement after the death of Stalin. The Samizdat emigre publications are extremely important. And I came across, it's thanks to Nazarov, a book by Nikolai Mitrokhin, not the more famous Mitrokhin, on the Russian party. Actually, it was his dissertation, which is what I read. The Russian Party, the movement of Russian nationalists in the USSR, 1953-1985, in Russian, published by the NLO Publishing House in 2003, based on his doctoral dissertation. Now, the author, the more famous Mitrokhin is Vasily, or Basil. I don't know if there's a relation here. I don't think there is. But the author, of course, is a liberal, a Democrat, a Westernizer. And he tends to simplify things, just like Americans do. Russian nationalism to him is just simplified as xenophobia, ethno-nationalist mythology, and all the nonsense that they promote. He also doesn't really know Orthodoxy very well. And he has a lot of very typical, superficial generalizations, trying to unite into one whole this motley group of patriots without any kind of in-depth analysis of their different positions, very different positions. The book is interesting, but it's a very limited use. And this goes back to, really, the Russian National Socialist Party was founded in 1956, lasted until roughly 1958. It had maybe 20 people. The All-Russian Social Christian Union for the Liberation of the People came into existence in 64, which is when Khrushchev was overthrown. It lasted until 1967. Most of its members went to prison. This was a social nationalism, more so than a national socialism. It had a strong connection to Nikolai Berdyaev and those around the turn of the 20th century, the Russian religious revival. But this group wanted to seize state power. It was designated a terrorist group in 1967 by the KGB. It was also a very obscure People's Democratic Party, maybe 10 people, 1955 to 1958. And there were a few others. But the fact that these existed at all, and you know, it sounds bad to have 20 people, 10 people, it just depends on who those people are and what they're capable of that matter. But you had others that were a bit more well-known. After the death of Stalin, and especially after the death of, the removal of Khrushchev, you had a group of grad students at the Philological Factory at Moscow State University, S.N. Simonov, Vladimir Kozinov, a few others. Mitrokhin calls them the young Orthodox anti-communists, although they would never have described themselves in that way. Circle of Nationalists, the University, the Young Marxists, 1963-1965. Vladimir Skrilatov and many others. By the way, the same people who distributed the Charter of Morality. But that was done on a pagan and fascist basis, not really Orthodox. There was very limited possibilities of any underground movement under totalitarianism. And any underground movements couldn't really influence the situation. But they themselves, the fact that they existed at all, says something about what was going on at the official level. The fact that these patriotic forces came into existence. In my book on Russian literature, which I reread it, it has to be redone, there's some errors in it, but I still like it. The first chapter is on the village prose school. That's one of the more powerful, active forces of the Russian nationalist movement at the time. These were not Westernizers that you'd see in the 1960s. They didn't just want to expose the crimes of the party, but they wanted to restore Russia, and hence Christian moral standards. There's a lot of very famous people. Vladimir Belov, who wrote Carpenter's Tales, F.A. Abramov in Priscilla from 58 to 73, Letters from a Russian Museum, and of course my favorite is Valentin Rasputin. Money for Maria, The Last Term, Farewell to Matera, 1976, and some of his political theory as well. This is an agrarian philosophy of the soil in, you know, it's basically poetry and fiction. They associated, and maybe properly so, the fate of Russia with the village, because the village, even at this point, had preserved its Russian character. So critics called them the village writers, and eventually that became the village prose school, at least in English. It was meant to be disparaging, but it certainly isn't. It lost the negative connotation. Well, one of the significant aspects here is that they broke socialist realism. They actually created a real criteria for good and evil. Not only did they show Soviet policy, its connection to the Enlightenment, and its obsession with science, the attempt to dominate nature completely, hence destroying many villages, fields and lands completely destroyed with these experiments. But there came a point where their books grew to 1 million, 2 million in circulation, accessible to everyone. It was one of the biggest anti-communist movements in literature, at least, from the 50s to the 80s. Almost all of them became figures in the Russian patriotic or Russian nationalist movement. You had magazines like Young Guard, a few other places. But they, at least, had to couch everything in the Soviet patriotic mainstream. The village prose wasn't really careful. But because it was done in a poetic and fictional way, they can get away with a little bit more. And something else happened in the 60s, after the overthrow of Khrushchev. This is actually mentioned in the CIA document I talked about. The Rodina Club, Rod, or family, genetic descent. But it came into existence not for that, but to protect Russia's monuments. Now, this became a huge movement. In and of itself, it seems to be, you know, we talked about monuments in this country quite often. The exact same thing was going on in the Soviet Union. The monuments that had not been destroyed at this point, they wanted to preserve. An article called Protect Our Shrines by Lev Leonov, which came out in the semi-Soviet patriotic Young Guard publication, Nikonov's publication. It soon became, though, the center of Russian nationalism, again, trying to expand the boundaries of what was permitted. That then became, 2 years later, the All-Russian Society for the Protection of Historical and Cultural Monuments, which was run by, P.D. Baranovsky, it's either Paul or Peter, who, by the way, was an architect who was functional before the revolution. Vladimir Shulukin, many others. The fact that this is actually mentioned in the CIA document I talked about is striking. It started off as like maybe 40 people, specialists in architecture, etc., from 67 to 72. They called it the Russian Club. Both the CIA and the Soviets said that they held anti-communist sentiments, Russian nationalism and xenophobia towards the West, which was itself a source of condemnation for the Soviets too. They never really, they didn't want to become political for very obvious reasons. Even in Perestroika, they didn't really become political. But because of that, because of how circumspect they were, they became very large. In the mid-70s, it had 6 million members throughout the country. And don't think that the party didn't realize what was going on here. Yeah, they didn't want to get into ideology or political stuff. They couldn't. The war was cultural. Those circles who under Khrushchev had resumed what the Leninists had started, the destruction of Russian architectural monuments, especially churches, and especially in Moscow. Now, Mitrokhin, in his book, he does admit, he says, Jews constituted a significant part of the leading Moscow architects, including those responsible for the development and implementation of the general plan for the development of the city. It's kind of like urban renewal. These Jews were going to bulldoze churches and many other types of older architectural monuments. And it was righteous to put the blame for a lot of this on them. They had no problem, of course, bulldozing very old churches for their, as Nazarov says, their modern masterpieces of concrete and glass. Stupid, you know, like the Palace of Congresses at the Kremlin or the Russia Hotel. The CIA explicitly calls this covert anti-Semitism. It becomes overt when they talk about the architects. So the ruling class, it doesn't matter where they're from, East or West, shows this mixture of a hatred for Russian history, and in Russia, an inferiority complex towards the Americans. This Jewish movement, you know, the opposite of the preservationist nationalist goal, the Jewish architects, they loved the skyscraper. They loved what New York City looked like. But that means there had to have been tolerant people within the party apparatus who would allow this stuff to go on. Jews were not happy. But there were plenty of others who said because they're not political, they should be permitted to function. The beginning of the Brezhnev period is where all of this really comes to a head. Liberals and Stalinists, to use very broad terms, or cosmopolitans and National Bolsheviks. Liberals were able to use anti-Stalin documents from the older congresses of the party under Khrushchev, 20th and 22nd. But of course, they pretended that Stalin was a Russian chauvinist, which is an entirely mythical and invented concept. Now, the nationalists, though, sought to rehabilitate Russian patriotism. But unfortunately, they didn't separate it from the figure of Stalin, because they would need him to legitimize themselves, the national leader who won the war. So in the heat of controversy, they would exaggerate his merits. Unfortunately, this is all they can do if they wanted to stay out of prison. So it's a matter of which authority do you pick. Jews and liberals look to Lenin. National Bolsheviks and various forms of patriotism look towards Stalin. It's false on both counts because ideologically Stalin and Lenin were identical. Lenin just had a very different system to work with. Writers in the Union of Writers, the Writers Union in the Soviet Union, like Yuri Bandarov, went far to make Stalinism the equivalent of Russian patriotism, which created an awful distortion. It continues today. The CIA bought into it, and it isn't true. If you've read my stuff, heard my stuff, Stalin was a committed internationalist, a cosmopolitan. He despised Russia. He despised any kind of nationalism. He even advocated one day the creation of a universal language. He was vehemently philo-Semitic, but I've said many times before, his purchase of the old Bolsheviks is really irrelevant. Well, they were mostly Jews anyway. So it's going to sound anti-Jewish, just given the list of people who he went after. But they weren't pursued because they were Jews. Now, even Brezhnev himself, though, like Stalin, was interested in encouraging a militarized or military patriotism. They noticed that during World War II, the interests of the party and the nation, as they conceived it, coincided for the first time. Regardless of your opinion on Hitler and Barbarossa, which was certainly no fault of the Germans, we know what was going to happen. They still invaded Russia. So, at least at an official level, you know, if you're I'm not ethnically Russian at all, but I picture myself at the time, I mean, you know, and they didn't realize that Stalin was planning a massive invasion of Central Europe, but there was this patriotic need of the Cold War, and that was probably the main reason for a while why the party patronized various forms of Russian nationalists. but they were tolerated because they cited Stalin as an authority. Not so much as he said anything like this. He persecuted the church as badly as anybody else. In 1944, maybe he had to let up for because of the Germans, but there were Stalinist patriots, not nationalists in any true normal sense. The very fact that you could be a Soviet patriot and an internationalist at the same time shows how absurd the entire thing is. One of the cardinal evils of the left is that even if they're correct on economics, say the anarchists or the Marxists at their best, they have nothing to tie anyone together. Even if somehow socialism was actually about workers and you created a worker-controlled country, why are they going to work at all? What are they sacrificing for? There has to be a nation. There has to be a family. And this is what the left will never understand. And of course, Marxism was never about labor. It was never about the proletariat. But this era, the Soviet Union, the patronage for certain types of nationalism, especially military nationalism, would show up time and again. Poltava and Stalingrad at one point were made equivalent, which is an error on many levels. One of my great criticisms of Putin is somehow he identifies, you know, the victory over Hitler as this great Russian nationalist victory, and it's no such thing. It was a glorious Stalin. But you had plenty of people in authority in the USSR at the time who were also anti-Western. So they saw allies all over the place. There were pragmatic, there were psychological, not ideological reasons for this coincidence of interest, and no more than that. The Pavlov Group, which was connected to a young guard, that publishing house, lasted for a while. Pavlov was the head of the Central Committee of the All-Union Leninist Young Communist League. They were basically national Bolshevik. But Pavlov himself showed his true colors when he attacked Solzhenitsyn. In fact, Solzhenitsyn was almost a litmus test for what kind of nationalist you were. The Red Patriots were condemning him all over the place. Let me quote Matrokin further, and he's talking by 1967. He says, part of this movement continued to remain on the positions of anti-Semitic Red Patriotism. Another part of the Pavlov movement, under the influence of nostalgic monarchists, primarily Ivan Glazunov, began to profess a set of ideals that being called Orthodox Monarchists or White Guard. By the end of the 1960s, the latter direction began to dominate the Pavlov group. Now, according to Matrokin, and he seems to be ready to apply the term Orthodox Monarchist to any anti-liberal who's also not a Stalinist, but you had patriots in the Writers' Union, and there was a connection there. There was also the Shalipin group in the higher apparatus. Alexander Shalipin was chairman of the KGB from 1958 to 1961, part of the Politburo, 1964 to 1975. He had a vague national Bolshevik idea. Vladimir Semichasny, who succeeded him as chairman of the KGB, 1961-1967, and Peter Dimitrov, the secretary of the Party Central Committee for Ideology, until 1974. Again, only 30 men total, but these were very important men. But if you read some of these guys or listen to their speeches, Semichasny talks about fighting nationalism in his own words. But what does he mean? He's talking about actual Russian nationalism, not Soviet patriotism. Now, we're not talking about Orthodox monarchists. They existed, but they had to be passive. Simonov, who I mentioned at the University of Moscow before, here's what he says about it. There was a vast and favorable environment here. Everyone who did not manage to marry in the Brezhnev style and was not irritated by the influence of the wise ones, that is, the vast majority of the ruling class, turned out to be very receptive to the ideas of nationality, order, traditionalism, rejection of any destructive modernism. The majority of the Russian intelligentsia of the 1970s remained in one way or another in the mainstream of cosmopolitan liberalism. However, the person we're talking about at the time was politically correct, bypassing the main circles of the intelligentsia, we address the middle strata of the party, as well as the army and the nation as a whole. That's where Marxist dogma had much less influence. Simonov was on the fringes of this nationalist movement at the time at Moscow. The sleeping group, the purpose there, again, this is the head of the KGB for a few years. He tried to counteract the pro-Western and Zionist liberal Jewish circles in the state apparatus, but that didn't mean he had any real connections with real Russian nationalists. They were politicians. And unfortunately, they didn't really have support outside of certain aspects of the elite, and they lost any chance of success. Shulipin, don't forget, was one of the organizers of Khrushchev's overthrow. The writings of George Arbatov, who's a liberal Jew, he even, according to him anyway, he wanted to be a successor to the temporary figure of Brezhnev. But by 1967, Shulipin's group lost its influence. Same thing for Pavlov. Semichasny was replaced by Andropov, who quickly and unequivocally, according to him, took a position of support for Brezhnev, joined carefully in the struggle to form the political positions of the new leader. He could play the role of a counterweight to negative pressures on a number of issues. Also, Shulipin also failed to kidnap Stalin's daughter, who had defected to the U.S., and bring her back. In the process of his failure, he exposed a few KGB agents in the West, and that didn't help him either when he was removed. Don't forget, Andropov was Jewish. His family comes from, his father was Vladimir Lieberman. His mother was named Feinstein. He did try to hide his national origin for obvious reason, but Brezhnev, Ukrainian from Eastern Ukraine, married a Jewish woman. And this was important for Andropov. This is how he opposed Russian nationalism. Shulipin's associates end up being transferred to secondary positions, and Andropov brought others, like Arbatov himself, Alexander Bovin, who became the first Russian ambassador to Israel after they were re-recognized again. Many others, Zagladin, for example, brought into the circle of Brezhnev's assistants, who prepared reports for him and thus had a great amount of influence on policy. People I mentioned were mostly Jews, either were or became liberals. Bovin was one of them. And the new acting head of the propaganda department was Alexander Yakovlev, who was a key ally. There's a lot of name dropping here, but these movements, remember, it doesn't matter if there's five members, who are the members? Now, the liberal group, the head of Brezhnev's secretariat, Zhukhanov, Alexandrov Egentov, who was Brezhnev's assistant for international affairs, and the far more famous Boris Ponomarev, who was head of the international department of the Party Central Committee, among other things. These are Jews, or at least married to Jewish women. Ponomarev actually was Andropov's boss before he became head of the KGB. Among the influential liberals in the Central Committee, the Andropov's people, Boris Grushnin, a Greek named Latsis, Vladimir Lukin, and others. And these are guys who came from the editorial office of the journal Problems of Peace and Socialism in Prague. They liked the idea of the Prague Spring. Now, Abatov is interesting. He wrote an autobiography called The System, An Insider's Life in Soviet Politics. He claimed that he was the major theorist of reform that laid the groundwork for perestroika. He was at the Institute for U.S. and Canadian Studies. And there were people who, he was okay at covering his tracks. He did criticize the anti-American hardliners in ruling circles. He knew there were certain lines he couldn't cross. Eventually, he knew that the Soviet Union lost the Cold War. But then Israel and liberalism became his primary focus. Anyway, that list of people, that's what Andropov brought in. They had a common strategic, tactical line in relation to both the West and the so-called right wing against nationalism and what he called the intensified Great Russian Chauvinism. Of course, when Andropov was appointed head of the KGB, one of the first things he did, actually was immediate, he created the Fifth Directorate for the fight against ideological sabotage, that is, against any dissent. It was headed by Philip Bobkov, a protege of Andropov. After the Communist Party fell, this was a KGB general, became one of the heads of the security service of the oligarch Kuczynski, chairman of the Russian Jewish Congress, although I'm pretty sure Bobkov is not Jewish himself. He admitted later that Andropov saw dissent as abnormal. Certain people he may patronize. He liked the poet Eugene Yevtushenko, who died in 2017. He's probably the most famous poet of the era, or probably the best-known poet there in the 60s. This is a man who was not Jewish. He could call Andropov at any time. He traveled to many countries, no problem. Never punished for bringing pornographic and even emigre political literature in the country. He even got the Order of the Red Banner of Labor. It's amazing how this guy was treated when you compare him to Solzhenitsyn. Patriots, of course, were treated quite differently. Yevtushenko also connected Stalinism with anti-Semitism. He, in fact, used the two terms interchangeably. Bobkov is important. We had a show lecture I did on trust, this project of the KGB to create organizations, dissenting organizations. Bobkov was a part of this later on. In 1983, he established the Anti-Zionist Committee of the Soviet Public. So, and there was a bunch of others that were, you know, less well-known. But it just shows you who these people are. When he retired in 1991, he joined Media Most as a security agent. And by the way, Kuczynski's Jewish media group had thousands of former KGB agents in various roles. In fact, the entire archive of the Fifth Directorate of the KGB was taken by Kuczynski into his media empire, the Most Empire. Allegedly, this group tried to assassinate Boris Berezovsky in 1994. I don't know how true that is, but they were rivals. There's a lot of secrets that the Jews in Russia have under the Media Most organization. Who has them now? I don't know. Bobkov has been dead for a little while. So, let's go back to 1968, the crisis in Czechoslovakia. It did frighten Brezhnev. But this so-called Eurocommunism, this liberalized communism, was something that the westernized and liberal Jewish dissenters liked. You couldn't say that openly, but you could criticize the what they call the reactionaries in ruling circles. But once that crisis took place, it terrified a lot of people, Brezhnev in particular. They saw it as a destabilizing influence, especially given how they had to deal with it. They repressed the movement. This was one of the big movements against the liberal dissenters. But even beyond that, like Novi Mir, which was a more or less liberal democratic journal, that was, the editor was fired. But patriotic journals like Inkonov, as I mentioned, were also fired. Russian Publishing House, Society for the Protection of Monuments, was purged. But patriotic circles, they did not pose a threat to the party like the Czechoslovak movement did. In 1972, the campaign against nationalism began. The attack on nationalism is very similar, whether in the Soviets or Soviet Union or in the USA or EU. It was noted as a bourgeois phenomenon, something that will go away once the regions of the Russian Empire are equalized. Of course, the opposite occurred. Let me quote Mitrokhin again from his dissertation. One of the few critics of ethno-nationalism in the apparatus of the Central Committee of the party, Ponomarev, was promoted, and the minister of the Georgian Ministry of Internal Affairs, Shevardnadze, famous for torturing prisoners, became the first secretary of the Central Committee of the Communist Party of Georgia. Alexander Yakovlev, supporter of Andropov, then attempted to deal a blow to the Russian nationalists in his sensational article, quote, against anti-historicism. Yakovlev fought against Russian nationalists, as many people in his position. The purge in various publications could not have occurred without his participation. After they were purged, he then called for their imprisonment. He did go too far. He eventually was shipped off as ambassador to Canada. There was a protest from writers of all stripes. And you have someone at the level of Mikhail Sholokhov, even the secretary of the Central Committee, the Mishiv, thought he went too far. Brezhnev wasn't going to mess with these people. And Andropov wasn't going to contradict Brezhnev. But the party, and when we're talking about true Russian nationalists, the party elite loathed them, the CIA loathed them, and Russian liberal dissenters loathed them. Trokin names a Ganichev as a leader of the orthodox anti-communist trend in the 70s and 80s, but he now, Ganichev is still alive, or if he died, it's very recent. He said, this is Ganichev, allegedly the orthodox anti-communist, says, we perceive the Reds first and foremost as Russians, and the Whites had the Entente. You know, he says the same about Kunyav, his alleged anti-communist views, Simonov. You know, he throws very different groups of people or individuals into the same boat. The Russian party, the Russian national movement, notice I say national, not nationalist, they weren't all anti-communist, or they weren't all anti-party. The majority, actually, of that movement defended Soviet power because they were trying to defeat the pro-Western forces in the Central Committee. They condemned Solzhenitsyn. Both the liberal dissenters and the Soviet patriots condemned Solzhenitsyn. That was almost a litmus test, as I said before. That's how you showed your loyalty. And Trokin, in his dissertation, he actually, some of his research was with interviews of the living people. It's over 20 years ago now. He never actually found a orthodox royalist, anti-communist, the church circles, anything like that. He never interviewed one. Now, it's true, at the time, they didn't participate in open political activity. But Matryokhin did this not in the height of the Soviet Union. He did it much later. Sometimes I think that Matryokhin didn't want to interview these people because it would simply throw a monkey wrench into his fairly simplistic theory. Now, the Stalinists, sometimes called the National Bolsheviks, maybe. There's some difference there, but Stalinists were grouped around a magazine called Moscow, run by Mikhail Alexeyev. And there were a lot of people, the former soldiers of the Great Patriotic War, that really began to coalesce under Brezhnev. They weren't particularly philosophical or ideological, but they joined together, right and left patriots, in the face of the pro-Western dissident opposition and its patrons. So you have factions of various types using each other for their own purposes. The Orthodox patriots had no hope of a career in the bureaucracy whatsoever. Some of them were in the magazine Vesha. That was around 1971, 1974. That was actually mentioned in the CIA article I've mentioned above. Zemla came out between 74 and 75. That had two issues. This was real Orthodox nationalism. The CIA was very upset that Vesha wasn't smashed earlier. It only got out 10 issues. It shouldn't have gotten out any, according to the CIA. In other words, the West, the Central Intelligence Agency, wanted to be far harsher on this dissent than even the Soviets did. That's not to say that the Orthodox parishes under the Soviets weren't doing their work. or Commandrite Tikhon Agrikov. He developed a movement to make the Trinity Lavra of St. Sergius really a center of Orthodox political thought, but it didn't take the Patriarchate long to get rid of him. I, of course, have to mention Dmitry Dudka. I mean, he baptized 500 people a year under the Soviets. There's nothing else he could have done. He couldn't have functioned. The underground church, he couldn't have functioned at all. But at least he was able to use his mainstream, quote-unquote, respectability, even though he was in the camps for a while, to publish some Orthodox literature and disseminate it. He was sent to the Gulag in 1956. The fact that these print runs were like 50, 100 copies didn't matter, because eventually they came to the Russian immigration. They were reprinted by the publishing house, Posev, and they were repackaged in runs of about 2,000 for sneaking into the Soviet Union. So by 81, 82, the Posev house became very important. So at this point, the division between Western and nationalist parts of the opposition to the party grew, and they were irreconcilable for very obvious reasons. It used to be that Safarovich and Solzhenitsyn collaborated with Sakharov. Now, of course, they couldn't cooperate at all. We talked about some of these people. Safarovich just a few months ago. Sakharov criticized Solzhenitsyn's letter to Soviet leaders, 1973. Earlier, Solzhenitsyn wrote his Reflections on Progress in 1968. That's where Solzhenitsyn laid out, polemically, the different directions of both Western and nationalist opposition movements. So Sakharov was worried about the fate of world democracy. Solzhenitsyn, far more worried about the fate of suffering Russia. I have the book. I think I mentioned it the last time we talked about this. The collective collection from Under the Rubble, which really was a continuation of the From the Depths, came out in 1974, right after Solzhenitsyn's expulsion. That also began to solidify the differences between the two dissenting movements. All of this was condemned by Western dissidents, you know, Brodsky, these Jews, because it was authoritarian. And they published their own set of essays in 1976. One was the USSR, Democratic Alternatives, and the other one was called Self-Consciousness, or could be translated as Self-Awareness. And what holds them together ideologically, and the authors say, I'm going to quote them here, that they're united by a deep spiritual closeness, kinship, with those people in Russian history and culture who, even in Tsarist times, fought against tyranny. Our opponents are no different, but essentially one and the same, common, although at different historical stages. One of the authors in Self-Awareness was Richard Pipes, a Russophobe amongst the American Sovietologists. And that very same year, he published an article where he explained communist aggression by the, quote, collective views of the Russian nation that could only be changed by a major cataclysm. In his mind. At one point, we talked about the nuclear concept of General Taylor. I think that was 2-3 weeks ago I talked about that, where only Russian areas of the Soviet Union should be wiped out by nuclear weapons and no other. Eurocommunism was something along the lines of the Czechoslovak, quote-unquote, liberal Marxism. That was represented by two Jewish authors, Roy and Zorz Medvedev. And they were also part of Western radio broadcasting. They became very important, but they didn't. That was out of proportion to the number of their supporters, who were very few. This is around the time that Russian patriots began to be called the Russian Party. If you remember last year, we talked about the Leningrad purge. With the Leningrad Affair. That was one of the first times the Russian Party was used. It kind of went away for a while because that went completely underground. But it shows that throughout the history of the Soviet Union, the one enemy was Russia. The one enemy was Russian nationalists. Russia was to be exploited and repressed. especially within their own country. The republics got away with things, maybe not Ukraine, but the republics got away with things so long as they kept their distance from Russia. The war on the, you know, the concept of science as materialist science, as a core of Marxism, which Karl Marx was not shy about talking about. Darwinism was central to it. Capitalism and Marxism, one of the many things they have in common. There was an attempt to divert the northern rivers to the south, which would have flooded Lake Baikal and destroyed. These were usually failures. But Stalin even had a bureaucracy. I'm doing this off the top of my head. The Committee for the Domination of Man Over Nature, or the Committee for the Domination of Science Over Nature. Very oddly named thing. I don't know how long it lasted, but I've come across that several times. But there was another milestone. Well, let me say that that movement to divert the rivers created a counter-movement against the state for doing this, knowing full well what was going to happen. Even if it was successful, it would destroy huge areas near Lake Baikal. But another milestone was the 600th anniversary of the Battle of Gulikova. Now that was used, and it was kind of tolerated at the time, to show the significance of St. Sergius and the Orthodox Church in Russian history, which normally you couldn't do. The 70s and 80s, you had a resurgence of Orthodoxy, and churchmen were fighting to open churches in various parts of the country. The Soviet press at the time, let's say 1976, estimated the number of Orthodox believers at 25 to 30% of the country. And that was in the context of the monument movement. They came right out and said, the desire to visit ancient monuments of a cult nature has increased. You are really seeing a growth, an interest in religion and the church. This was official statements. At the same time, the Village Prose movement acquired great significance. That was a huge blow to the foundations of the Marxist system. I don't think many Americans understand that, because it also struck a huge blow at the foundations of the American capitalist system. Liberals tended only to see the consequences of the party apparatus, where Village Prose, of course, in Orthodoxy, saw the core of it. The early Khrushchev era, the so-called thaw years, literature was permitted to expose the past crimes of the USSR. And maybe that this new change in leadership is going to be a way out of the darkness. There was a flurry of civic activity because we knew that the Russians knew that there were changes in leadership coming. Brezhnev was seen somewhat as a temporary measure. Andropov, Chernenko, also very temporary or elderly. This instability. You know, I've said this before, but the Soviet Union never, you know, Stalin was the core of the USSR. Follower of Lenin, Trotsky, regardless of, you know, any personal disagreements they may have, that was the only way that system was going to work. Trying to liberalize it in fits and starts like they did, only, especially when you have nothing holding the country together. Because the left doesn't comprehend that the national homogenous culture is required for any civic life at all, they had to kind of create, backhanded, this Soviet patriotism, which was incoherent, of course, but they knew that they needed it. You have people so stupid who think that because Stalin would occasionally use the church near the end of the war, near the end of World War II, thus he was an Orthodox patriot. Now, these are people who will read a propaganda leaflet and take it as evidence of something, taking them at the word. Dudka, very important. But other than him, there was something called the Christian Committee for the Defense of Believers' Rights. Some of you may have heard of that. Gleb Yakunin, and a few others. You had religious philosophical seminars, Vladimir Porras and a handful of others. They got terms in the camps as a result, most of them. Someone else, I mentioned the St. Sergius Lavra. Well, there was another movement at Pochiev, an Orthodox Patriotic Center. That was also attacked by the state. a case was open against them for reproduction of religious literature. So you had a bunch of people expelled, along with the abbot, who was Abbot Ambrose. The police then killed Archimandrite Alippi. You know, so much for, you know, a Soviet patriarchate. There were plenty of people there who knew what was happening. This also meant, late 70s, there was another anti-religious movement. You had raids on churches and believers' homes. It's exactly what's going on in the Jewish movement in Ukraine today, including Apochev. But the persecution of Orthodox patriots intensified when Andropov took over from Suslov, who was the former secretary of the Central Committee for Ideology. Lev Borodin, who was the editor of the Orthodox collection Hope, was arrested in 82. Then you had a series of searches and interrogations between 80 and 82, and a whole bunch of people got prison terms. That's how they took care of this resurgence. Now, I don't want to make it seem like liberal dissidents weren't harassed. They were. Few of them were arrested. But they had patrons in Britain and America. Their organizations, their literary publishing circles were not purged. But patriotic figures began to be dismissed en masse wherever they were. Between 80 and 82, a whole bunch of people, Yuri Zelezhev, V.A. Ustinov, many others removed from their posts. Valentin Rasputin, my favorite of the Village Prose writers, was beaten by security officers a few times. And, you know, one of the things about Soviet patriotism is at the time, internationalist work was connected with this. They were propagandizing this to the army in connection with its fulfillment of their internationalist duty in Afghanistan. How anti-racist we are of assisting these backward souls. One of the reasons for this vehement suppression, among everything else that I've mentioned, from above and below, was that 16 months in Poland in 1980. That was achieved by Solidarity and that wave of national religious upsurge. Now, a repeat of this, especially where the 600th anniversary of the Battle of Kutukovo was coming up, that was feared by the party apparatus, as well as liberal dissenters. Liberal dissenters will run and join with the hardest line communists to destroy them. And this, so this is, you know, they're full of it. I could say the same of certain Soviet nationalists, though. Internationalists like Suslov and Budimatov, as well as your Western-oriented liberals, which the people who were connected with Andropov. Now you see the phrase Russia Party in the media all the time. But there was no party. There really was no movement. That's part of the reason why they failed. They didn't have money flowing in from Jews, from Western sources. On March 28th, 1981, Andropov made a secret report to the Politburo. It was only declassified or really became known after the fall of the party. I'm going to quote it here. This is what Andropov says about the nationalists. Recently in Moscow and a few other cities in the country, a new trend has emerged in the mood of a certain part of the scientific and creative intelligentsia, calling themselves Russists. Now I have to stop there. I guess he means Russia-ists. They don't even know the name. What he means by Russists are the Russia Party. Anyway, under the slogan of defending Russian national traditions, they are in fact engaged in active anti-Soviet activity. This activity is taking place in a different, more important environment than the so-called human rights activists who have suffered defeat and discredited themselves in the eyes of public opinion. A study of the situation among the Russists shows that this circle of their supporters is expanding and, despite its heterogeneity, is acquiring an organizational form. The danger lies primarily in the fact that Russism, that is, demagogy about the need to fight for the preservation of culture, historical monuments, and for the saving of the Russian nation, in quotes, is used to cover up the subversive activities of outright enemies of the Soviet system. Well, this wasn't meant for publication. I think everyone knew what he meant by Russis or Russism. It's just the Russia Party. He's throwing any kind of pro-Russian movement, no matter what they are, into one bin and saying that they have to be crushed, as did the CIA. So then the report, he outlines a bunch of candidates, mentions a bunch of candidates for criminal prosecution, and it was marked top secret for a long time. The Politburo took note, but there wasn't any real agreement on how to proceed. You had some who just wanted to smash it. Others thought maybe we could use it. But the advisors and speechwriters who were brought into Brezhnev's apparatus by Andropov saw this as one of their main priorities. So in February of 1981, this was the time of the 26th Congress of the party, Brezhnev was very ill. He had, you know, a paper handed to him. I don't think he fully understood the meaning of what he was saying. He demanded war against, quote, a departure from a clear class assessment of individual historical events and figures. What he meant was Marxism has to be the one ideology. If it doesn't have a class basis, it's nothing. The official magazine Communist in 1982 began a campaign against the main organ of the Russia Party, accusing it of promoting the, quote, mystical religious views of party member Shulukin. April, Andropov became the secretary of the Party Central Committee for Ideology, and on June 30th of 82, Pravda published a resolution of the Party Central Committee on criticism of the village prose writers. And here's what that said. Events of national history, the socialist revolution, collectivization, are depicted with serious deviations from the truth of things. Some publications contain biased, superficial judgments about modern times, the authors of which display ideological confusion and inability to consider social phenomena historically from clear class positions. November 1982, Andropov takes over. General Secretary, he purges Russian patriots from everything, especially for their attitude towards religion. The end of 82, there was an all-union seminar held for media workers on the topic of, quote, the role of mass media in the atheistic education of workers. Well, today that would be found in various, you know, Bilderberg kind of meetings, getting together, the regime members getting together and working this out. It's the same kind of thing. So they created these councils of the district, city, and regional committees of the party. Atheist offices were created, even in housing projects, maintenance offices, coming right from the Jewish movement in the 1930s. They built atheist agitation trains, forcible meetings with former believers that they said how awful everything was. They quickly made a bunch of films, propaganda films, like one was called The Truth About the Saints, and the other one made fun of it, called The Truth About Blessed Xenia. So Andropov had a brief struggle with religion, and he interpreted this as the unity of internationalist and atheistic education. Instructional work with that very same name, published in 1983, by a guy named Vladimir Zhots, one of the leaders of the Institute for Scientific Atheism at the Academy of Social Sciences. We just call them academics today. Against that background, the return of St. Daniel Monastery to the church was clearly a propaganda ploy, because that was done at this very same time, maybe to make sure that the high levels of church leadership would remain loyal to the party, at the same time making sure that carefully selected officials were promoted to the episcopate, who really had no right to be there. Even Vladimov, who was a Jewish writer, emigrated to the West, said this: "The Russian party is becoming the main target of persecution. The Russian idea is truly a danger, and for good reason. After all, it is essentially a second positive program, which is newer and more attractive than the Marxist-Leninist one." Now, according to Matrokin, Andropov had another point of view. I'm going to quote Matrokin here. "The significant guilt of the members of the Russian nationalist movement was their connection with the NTS. NTS, by the way, the People's Labor Union of Russian Solidarists, was a nationalist political organization of white emigres founded after the Civil War. To continue, all participants in the movement arrested and convicted in the 1970s and 80s were connected with this organization." Now, to quote from Matrokin, and of course it still exists today, in the immigration. Lev Borodin, in May of 1983, he had served 6 years in prison. he was then resentenced to 10 years in the camps and 5 years of exile, just for his fiction work, published by Posios, as I mentioned already. A lot of this punishment did not occur to well-known liberal dissidents, but they were connected abroad. They were often Jewish. They had powerful American foundations and structures that waged war against the, quote, Stalinists in the USSR. But they were not published as harshly, punished as harshly by Andropov in those years. Andropov rose to his post entirely due to Brezhnev. It's clear that it was Andropov who played on Brezhnev's ambitions, indulging in his passions and drives, who created the cult of Brezhnev. If there's one person you can't create a personality cult around, it would be him. Andropov gained power, quote, by promoting his own protégés to key positions, by purging the party apparatus, and by provoking the general secretary's closest supporters. There's a few people, and I forget about this sometimes, Lieutenant Elin's assassination attempt on Brezhnev. That occurred on January 23, 1969. Probably it was a provocation, an inside job to convince Brezhnev of the need to strengthen the role of the KGB, of course, Andropov himself, as well as the other things that he added to, like the Fifth Directorate. In 1974, Andropov created his own secret anti-terrorist special forces of the KGB, the Alpha Group, which, of course, could be used for any purpose whatsoever. Andropov was destroyed his rivalry. You know, Khazar mentality. 1975, there was a string of deaths. Healthy men. Kulikov, 1978. The deputy head of the Ministry of Internal Affairs, Paputin, 1979. The death of Masharov in a car accident, 1980. The Ministry of Internal Affairs, Azerbaijan. The head, Gaidarov, and his deputy. The Council of Ministers chair, or Kyrgyzstan, Igragimov, they were shot from crime, I guess. Georgian colleague, Petaridze, died in a car accident. The first secretaries of Tajikistan, Yakutia, Tatarstan, second secretaries of Ukraine and Leningrad died. They were healthy men. They died unexpectedly. Suicide, whatever. This, of course, is no coincidence. This is Andropov. And he was able to replace these guys with his own men. There was a, and what I'm saying here, because he was a Jew, Brezhnev's wife was a Jew, this was a very minor, it was successful, but only very temporarily, revitalization of Jewish power in the USSR for a very brief period of time. It didn't have any staying power. There was a lot of corruption in Brezhnev's family that some people in the press actually had exposed. His daughter and her husband, who, by the way, was a deputy minister of internal affairs, Chobanov. His wife and her sister and her husband, who was the deputy chair of the KGB, Tsvigun, who Brezhnev had assigned to Andropov. Rumor was spread about the discovery of all these valuables in his apartment and his alleged suicide. Suslov died very suddenly a few days later. This was shaking any faith in the party, if there was any left anyway. But Brezhnev was very, very sick regardless. At the same time, the Western media loved Andropov. Regardless of his fanatical Leninism, he was an intellectual. He was a reformer. He was a Westernizer. He spoke English. He read American novels. He loved jazz and abstract art. He's a Jew, so anti-Semitism is gone. Andropov was treated with kid gloves in the West for very obvious reasons, despite his torturing of his rivals. But that's nothing new for Americans. Thank God, Andropov was only in power for a year. His last few months, he wasn't functional at all. In fact, you know, the West was so close to the Soviet Union. They brought in professor of, I don't know if it was Columbia University Med School, they brought in Rubin, Professor Rubin, to specifically treat Andropov. So the Soviets actually bring in Jewish Americans from New York to provide medical care for their sworn enemy. You know, it's nonsense. Chernyenko didn't matter. The Russian party was mainly concerned with what would happen after him. At this point, the big question is, what's going to happen? Not when Chernyenko dies, but when the system finally collapses. This is what Solzhenitsyn was worried about. It's going to be a point, the system collapses, who is in a position to take over? What happened in the 1990s was predicted. They didn't know when it was going to happen. But they said if the system collapses under its own weight, the westernized intelligentsia, the Jews, Jewish liberals, in connection with the U.S., are going to rape the country. I don't even think the word rape is harshly enough. Anyway, I've gone way over my normal time. I want to end simply by saying that everyone knew at the time something serious was going to happen. This list of leaders. I mean, Brezhnev was there for a while, but he was the opposite of charismatic. Then you have two people in succession. You have Andropov and Chernyanka. Something had to give. Corruption scandals all over the place, the defeat in Afghanistan. The problem was that the Jewish left, Jewish liberals, were in a much better position internationally than the Russian nationalists were. Even in the immigration, Solzhenitsyn called the communist regime the concentration of world evil. Problem is, divisions amongst the patriots, the fact that they didn't have this backing elsewhere, the so-called right wing, and many good people, the Solzhenitsyn included, realized that the system could not collapse suddenly. You have a moral disintegration, you have disintegration intellectually of the ruling class. Context is everything. This is, Ivan Ilyin said this in his Our Tasks, right after World War II. It's one thing for the totalitarian system to fall, but if that system has atrophied moral sense, then what is that new system going to look like? Ultimately, what happened was that many patriots said the Soviet system, on some semi-patriotic level, is better than the total collapse that eventually occurred in the 1990s. And to some extent, they're probably right. You didn't want to live in Russia in 1995. And that means many of them threw in their lot with the continuation of the Soviet Union. Solzhenitsyn was very vague about it. He knew that if the system was to go away, whatever government would rule would have to rule very, very, you know, like a Soviet government, even using a lot of the old symbols and slogans, slowly replacing them with something else. But that was a pipe dream. Given the nature of the church at the time, it was in no position to do anything. Of course, this was one time where the church as an institution could shine, could change things. It had tons of public support. It still does. The patriarch has been the most trusted man in Russia after Putin for 20 years, according to both domestic and foreign polls. But ideologically, it was terrified of saying anything. It didn't have a whole lot of people who were willing to say anything. People were talking about Orthodox Leninism and Orthodox Stalinism. You can't have a movement based on this blatant contradiction. I always love to use the example of the Roman Catholic Orangemen. It doesn't make any sense. Many Russian nationalists, or I should say patriots, went to the party, supported the coup of 1991, a coup attempt in 1991, because they knew what would happen when that party would go away. They had, you know, Solzhenitsyn's point of view as to what to do about it. In other words, they spoke like, they used the language of the lesser of two evils. People like Shumanov, Karelin, Brilutsky, the magazine Many Years, which only existed for five issues, defended these kind of positions. Anti-Zionists, anti-Western, many of them were Jews. Trying to talk about Orthodox Leninism, this was a temptation. What kind of movement could be based on such blatant contradiction? Because they eventually went to the party after Andropov to maintain, you know, for the Western liberals in the U.S. to completely take over, to keep that from happening. They were in a very difficult position. the organizations arose, the movement of Russian nationalists didn't need any coordinating body. And many Russian nationalists lost interest in it, especially if they supported the coup attempt in 1991. This amorphous, very broad movement of Russian nationalists, which didn't even have a name, they never developed independently any common strategy. They kind of reacted rather than created policy. They were never able, especially with the lack of church support, they were never able really to become a political organization as opposed to a literary one. Anyway, all of this is extremely important as far as the collapse of the USSR and the situation that occurred in the 1990s. You know what sort of nationalism is supported on this show, and it has nothing to do with what we're talking about here. And that is why liberals and Jews took over in the early 90s. Thank you, everyone, for listening, and I will talk to you next week. Bye-bye.